Namaste and in La Ketch, and welcome to this edition of One World in a New World. I'm your host, Zen Benefiel, and this week's guest is a very interesting fellow, a professor actually, Roger Gottlieb, who is a professor of philosophy at Worcester Polytechnic Institute, and I hope I pronounced that correctly.
Close enough.
He's an award-winning author or editor of 21 books on philosophy, religious studies, environmentalism, and contemporary spirituality. Some of those books are Spirituality, What It Is and Why Does It Matter, and Why It Matters, A Spirituality of Resistance, Finding a Peaceful Heart and Protecting the Earth, Morality and the Environmental Crisis, The Sacred Earth, and most recent, The Sacrifice Zone. So Roger, wonderful to have you here. This is going to be a delightful apocalyptic chat, I can tell already.
Thank you for inviting me. Pleasure to be here.
Very good. So as always with my guests, we explore, and you know, I'm finding, I've done almost a couple hundred shows now, and in these interviews, it's interesting that most everyone has had an inner journey. And sometimes, most often, I think we don't ever talk about those. We live half inside and half outside, and we're bereft of understanding in the inside, let alone talking about it openly, because when we do, it often sounds like we're some kind of new age wacko, right? Or a bit, you know, crazy or something like that, at least to those who have had no direct experience of that. That direct experience is growing, it seems, and we'll talk about that as we move into this. But for you, when did your opportunity present itself to become aware that there is that inner environment and there's access to it?
I think there are a number of things. I wasn't tremendously happy in my family. My father was authoritarian. I had a refuge, and we lived in a nice suburban area, and there were woods behind my house, and the natural world became my refuge. At a very, very young age, I felt this kinship with trees, you know, with the sky, with the clouds. Music brought me out of myself and helped me get in touch with emotions. And I was raised to be an emotionally repressed man. You know, the only emotion you're supposed to feel is anger.
Right.
And so I would listen to Rachmaninoff alone in my living room and cry, you know, which
he's one of my wife's favorite composers.
There you go. And also, as I had some disappointments in high school, things I tried to do and failed at. And at the same time, I was reading Thoreau's Walden. And he presented a model of how to live that was not based in accomplishment, possession, money, status. You know, I was in high school where I wanted to get straight A's and go to, you know,
sure,
go to
a sure. great college. It's interesting how we have that fear of failure, right? We still call it failure, even though with all the current conversations and understanding of the process of success, those aren't failures at all. They're just things that you tried that didn't quite fit or gave you something more to learn that you then built the skill set. Right.
So Thoreau posed an alternative. And I think that was the first time I saw the notion of what I call spirituality posed as an alternative to what I had been taught. Later on, I took a great deal of LSD and had some cosmic experiences. You know, I learned to meditate. I studied various forms of yoga. Things began to develop. In my late 30s, I did a return to Judaism for a period of time and connected with the spiritual powers of the tradition. And I've experienced death, not my own, but two of my three children have died. So, you know, without some spiritual resources, I wouldn't have made it through.
Sure.
And I'm enormously grateful to the people who taught me and the books I read. I'm a reader. I'm a professor and I write books. So I read, and I've read many important books. And I think that was much more important than any particular individuals. I didn't have a guru. I didn't have a teacher, but
sure.
my teachers were on the printed page.
Right.
From Thoreau and Kierkegaard and so forth.
Not to interrupt, I'm going to interrupt.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
That's what conversation does, right? Do you find that the experience that you have, regardless of the books, the teachers, all of that, that's kind of outer stuff. On the inner side, the experience that you develop, has that offered more wisdom in your world than the books and the teachers?
You know, as a card-carrying intellectual, I want to say that the books are really part of me. They are interior because in my serious assimilation of them, some of these books I've read, a number of different times, I was reading at a high level, a very young age. They have an enormous, I think about them. They live inside me. Kierkegaard, 19th century Christian, Danish, really the first existentialist writer, was just the way, I mean, he
Well, it
made a
promotes
great difference.
curiosity to further dive deep into your own being.
There was a collection of short stories by Yitzhak Loeb Peretz, who was the second most famous Yiddish writer at the turn of the last century. And he had told these stories about rabbis who were fasting and miracle workers and secrets. And it opened a world. You grow up in 1950s America, and like Abraham Heschel said, religions had everything. They had beautiful buildings and they had highly taught pastors and rabbis. They had everything except one thing, any kind of spirit whatsoever. And that's the kind of temple we went to. It had no spirituality whatsoever. So, but these little thing, bits and pieces would filter in the absurdities of Zen koans,
Now,
those
isn't that a
crazy
sense,
stories.
though, as far as you know, the card-carrying intellectual is like that? Yeah, I get that. I'm kind of that way too. Early readings, as a teenager, I was reading the Urantia book. And did copious amounts of LSD as well. So
Don't knock
You
it.
find structure and availability for curiosity in many realms through that, especially when you can enter things that realm with eyes closed. The outer world, kind of morphs a little bit. However, it's that inner relationship that means the most. Now,
Let me tell you one story about
sure.
my inner life. This is when I had graduated college. I lived in London with a woman I knew from when I spent my junior year there. We took a long trip to India, came back. India was like adventure. It wasn't like finding a guru. We
And a
hiked up the mountain.
fascinating one, I'm
We
sure.
hiked up to Mount Everest for 30 days and all kinds of stuff. Anyway, so I came back. I went to start graduate school at Brandeis. And I had picked up a book in India on yoga for 10 cents, so I started doing yoga. Who knew why? I did it. And I came back and I found this thing called Kundalini yoga, which is a kind of dynamic yoga where you move your body, a very intense breathing. At the end, it was taught by my dentist. It was the 70s, it was a different
Well,
time.
interestingly enough, I met my wife at her Kundalini yoga teacher
There you go.
training
Sat nam, sat
graduation.
nam, sat nam. So at the end
Sat-nam.
of the class, which was taught in the basement of one of the Harvard buildings, we did a 15-minute meditation with a mantra. So I'm sitting there, cross-legged meditation posture. And after about 6 minutes, my hip starts to hurt. By 10 minutes, everything starts to hurt. But I'm Roger Gottlieb, right? I'm not going to be defeated by this. So after 15 minutes, the guy rings the bell.
Right. Push through.
And thank God I moved my legs. And then I had this incredible insight, right? Nobody was forcing me to sit that way. They wouldn't have cared if I moved, if I got up and sat in the chair. Nobody would have cared. But it was me putting this barrier around myself saying, you have to do this. And
Prescriptive activity, not.
that's right. It was like, you have to go to a therapist for 6 months to get that insight. And it was just so clear that if you sit there doing nothing, all the features of your personality play out in your mind and you get to witness them. And hopefully you can learn a little to handle them a little better.
Depending on how well you can observe them,
That's right.
right?
And if you're willing to change.
Now that's the key. If you're
Right.
willing to share, because without that, you're just talking to yourself and you really don't get
Right.
any global perspective, if you will, or at least a larger one from others to, because we're basically all, in my opinion, assimilationists. Right, we're curators of all the information that we have available and are curious about, and take that. Sometimes even if we're not curious about, it's just stuff we have to learn, and then we're able to create an experience from that. That then, for me, often supplants a belief system, because the belief systems come from history, culture, programming, bloodline, saw all of those kinds of things, like Bruce Lipton and that crowd kind of gets into is, okay, this is our unconscious mind of what we carry from our past. Now, how do we bring that effectively into the present and yet not be controlled by it?
Well, you know, culture, human beings are the only species that live by culture. We do all kinds of things that other animals would just scratch their heads or use their paws to scratch something. What are these people doing? Denying their instincts, like don't have sex because you're a minister. Try to act in terms of what people did 1,000 years ago. That's crazy. Mm-hmm. And on and on and on. So we can't function without culture. Children who are raised without culture never develop into human beings. Where they've seen that with children raised by animals or infants in Chinese orphanages, where they just had enough people to feed them and change the diapers. They didn't interact. Kids never learned a language. So human beings need a culture, but cultures, until we reach that final sort of 1984 condition when everything is totally controlled, is dialectical, which just means there are different tendencies, there are contradictions, there are struggles. And that's what gives us the space for some kind of creativity, whether it's the creation of a new political movement like feminism in the late 1960s, or technological inventions.
Or live and let live in the 2020s.
Live and let live, right?
Now, because you're talking about the opening, an opportunity.
Right.
Do you feel that there's a silver lining in the recent kerfuffle that we've experienced that was called COVID? That gave people an opportunity, at least initially with the behavior mod patterns that were installed, the obsession on self-hygiene,
mm-hmm.
and the sequestration. That seems like a perfect storm for self-examination. Have you seen that? And if so, what do you see as the indications that maybe we've learned something and we're moving towards something a little more holistic?
No.
Okay.
You know, the reason I'm not invited to cocktail parties is that I'm really depressing. What I see is that people hunkered down with whatever they took into that situation with them.
Mm-hmm.
So if they took it into them rage and, you know, self-exaltation, then they raged against it. If they took it into it, you know, sort of middle and upper class capacity to do it okay with the money, they took selfishness and a lack of concern, and people writing things, oh, this is okay for me. I'm sitting on my balcony and looking at the flowers without concerns for all the people who were dying or suffering, or the incredibly overworked medical people
mm-hmm.
who sacrificed a tremendous amount to take care of the rest of us. You know, human culture is really struggling. It's really struggling. More than half the world lives under explicitly fascist regimes. And in those countries that aren't that way, have fascist movements within them, including the United States of America. So,
fortunately, that seems to be true today.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that there is a global assault on thought. Never mind the propaganda and the control and the, you know, if you say something contradictory in China, they knock on your door and they take you away. Thank God we haven't reached that point yet here. But cell phones and this constant attention to these devices is really, I think, deteriorating human intelligence, because it's too fast. You're constantly going from one to the next. You're put in a situation where your desires are endlessly capable of being satisfied. I mean, what is the internet, in a sense? It's like this infinite mall. So if you remember malls, people used to go into a mall to buy a pair of socks, and a half an hour later they found out that they couldn't live without these six other things.
Right.
They didn't realize it. But to go to a mall, you got to get up and go to the mall, park and stuff. The internet's right there, and there's always that sense that you miss something. So 2 hours later, you turn off the goddamn machine and you feel, you know, like you've been inside a vacuum cleaner. And you know, there is this tremendous freedom of the internet to publish and say whatever you want everywhere, you know, within certain limitations.
Right.
The downbeat is that the downside is that nobody's edited. Nobody's subjected to the slightest bit of editorial criticism. Now, a lot of editorial criticism is one-sided, but at least it raises the discussion to a higher level than some guy in TikTok saying, whatever the Chinese government told him to say so he could create divisiveness in the United States of America. It's too bad. And the human relationality of it. You know, my students come into my class a few minutes early. I put on the board, turn off your phone. They look at me. Oh, my God. Turn. See, meditate. Like, daydream. Oh, talk to the person next to you. And after we have 7-week terms, we're not like other universities. After a few weeks, they actually come in and talk to one another. But nobody had ever done that with them. Nobody had ever said, turn off your phone and talk to the other people.
Well, you know, that's an interesting point that you raise, is that having the consciousness or awareness to make that simple suggestion or the classroom boundary.
Right. Right? Yeah. Yeah.
And this is a lot about how we set our boundaries or don't, depending on how aware we are that we can do it,
right.
How free thinking we are. And you know, I totally understand where you're coming from, and the world seems from that perspective to be really caught up in less than what it could be. Let's just put it that way. And that there, what I've noticed though, and I, when COVID happened, when we went on lockdown here, I turned to my wife and I said to her, you know, I really hope the obsession on self-hygiene and sequestration gets people to look inside and figure out who they are. And shortly thereafter, that was in March. And then by the end of the year, I noticed a lot of different virtual groups popping up online of people who were forethinking and futurist minded. Mm-hmm. And they were looking for each other, trying to figure out, okay, we've made it through this. You know, for us, we COVID had no effect on us. We went out, we did things, life is normal, no masks, no vaccines, no nothing. And we advanced because of that, intellectually, spiritually, and even financially. So with that being our model of how to deal with that, I found it, you know, interesting that then all of these other folks were similarly bound, or boundless, more like it, and they were beginning to find each other, like, you know, the starting of the live and let live movement on the two basic principles: be an excellent human and don't aggress. And then you've got things like the regenerative collab, which are drawing people with these regenerative culture ideas and ideals and trying to implement them in their various bioregions.
Right.
So these kinds of things I find is at least encouragement in the hopeful category.
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, in my experience, and, you know, I've been on the left, you know, my whole adult life, which is pretty long at this point. I tell my students, I'm so far to the left, I fall off the planet occasionally. But
space is not a bad place to be.
No, you know, the excesses and insanities of a good deal of the American left have left me totally cold, totally in despair at what these people think they're doing, which is more like Stalinism than any reasonable progressive movement. But the one place where I have the most hope and where I personally feel committed totally is the environmental movement. I think it may be because the environmental movement is about caring for all of life. It's not one group as against the other, whites against blacks against whites, Jews, Palestinians. No, it's about all of life. That's the unit of concern for the environmental movement. And the kind of ego tripping and narrow-mindedness and inability to tolerate disagreement, I haven't found that in the environmental movement. I'm not saying it's not there. I'm saying I personally haven't seen it, and I've looked at a good deal of it. I mean, one of my major areas is religious environmentalism, and I just haven't found it there. And it's also left wing. I mean, I'm on the editorial boards of both the leading religious journal of the environment and the leading left wing journal of the environment, because political and spiritual, that's what I try to put together.
Sure. And these and people, those need to come together. Yes. It's all about, in my opinion, let me ask you this too. Does it seem like it's more like it's just this essence of common sense? And then the question is, okay, how do, because common sense seems to be rare, how do we make sense common?
But well, you try to find places where the two things are natural allies. And again, in religious environmental movement, you have people who have a deep concern for spirituality, deep concern for the what's called the great teachings of the religions without their anti-Semitism and pogroms and,
sure,
and
all of
inquisitions
them
and all
have
that kind
two
of stuff.
elements, and from what I can see, and having been down a similar path as you, two things: to love and be loved.
Right. Well,
It's really
or
the
yeah, to
core of it
love,
all. What is that?
to
How
care,
do
and
we
yeah,
live that?
right. You know, the Buddhists have a term, upaya, which means basically skill and means. So if you're going to love, you got to be skillful at it, because sometimes it takes a great deal of skill, like with your mother-in-law. So the religious environmentalists have that. They also are sophisticated enough to have a detailed critique of capitalism. So here you get the kind of fusion of a spiritual perspective, which emphasizes the importance of spiritual values like humility, like love, like compassion. And you get the political critique of these social slash economic slash political structures, which are really creating, directing the assault on life on Earth. So you get those two things together. There's a recognition of the relationship of this has to racial domination in environmental justice movement. You have a relationship to sexism and ecofeminism. All these things come together. And that's one of the things I was very happy to be part of, because when I worked with secular radical philosophers, that's my discipline is philosophy, I use the word spiritual and their eyes would glaze over. I mean, nice folks, you know, I'd worked with
I
them
know.
for
Why
years.
is it that that one word
Because,
seems to draw so much vacancy in the
well, talk to
eyes
any
when you bring it up?
ex-Catholic, right? And the ex-Catholics, they hate it the most. That's in my experience, because a good deal of religion is repressive, small-minded, biased, demanding that you accept without question really unlikely things, you know, like virgin birth, like resurrection, like God making the sun stand still when Joshua fought to conquer the land. All these things, which are, they may be true, but accept them without any, really accept them, know that they're true? No. So there's all kinds of, plus there's a sort of inbred patriarchal domination that's common to all the world's great religions. None of them were created by people who took care of children.
Age, right?
Yeah, none of the people who made the world's great religions ever got pregnant or took care of small children. So something was missing there, and still is in certainly Catholicism, in Islam, and Orthodox Judaism. They haven't made any progress.
Well, there's a constant creation of fictitious enemies.
That's right. Yeah, right. So that's there. And on the other side, religious people can look at the violence, the authoritarianism, the lockstep thinking of political people and say, oh, we don't want to talk about politics. So the idea in my mind, and I've written a lot about this, is for political and spiritual people to learn from each other, spiritual people to look at what political people have to say about the actual historical situation that they're in, and political people to look at spiritual people for lessons in virtues, so that the ego tripping, the domination, the power, the abusiveness, the violence of political movements can be curbed somewhat. Mm-hmm. So together, so you got something, which is why a collection of my essays was called Political and Spiritual.
So I think I know I'm feeling that essence too. And part of how I express it, and this may be useful too, you have two agendas, one in place currently, profit over people and planet. And then you have a new agenda that seems to be wanting to be expressed a bit more, and that's people and planet over profit. Now, it doesn't do away with profit, because there is this economic system that, until we can figure out a better way, that we have for now. It's how it's used. And the systems, it seems, don't necessarily have fault. It's just the management that could be better of them. So the distribution of food, clothing, medical supplies, all of those kinds of things can be more ubiquitous, for lack of a
better. They can be more rational too. I mean, nobody thinks
exactly
twice about introducing some new toxin because it's going to give you a very short-term profit or a short-term advantage in some way. No, the problem is that the system necessarily has built into it a continually small and ever more powerful tiny minority of people who are controlling the planet. And they not only control the economic system, but because of their enormous wealth, They control the political system as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so now the problem then is that a socialist alternative. I've been a socialist since I was 23. Last week, no, I've been a socialist since I was 23.
Happy birthday.
The problem then, thank you. The problem then is, are ordinary people capable of taking part in the processes of what we might call self-management? Self-managed, because if they're not,
that
then
takes
you get
a certain amount of education, right?
Yeah, then you, yeah, but who's going to educate the educators? Marx said, "Who educates the educators?"
Right.
So the problem is that, you know, look, years ago, this is a long time ago, 1950s. there was the question: should the United States withdraw from the United Nations? Right, we had lost China, and who lost China? All this kind of thing was going on. So they did a survey: should the United States withdraw from the United Nations? And 40% of the Americans who were asked this question didn't know what the United Nations was. Okay, you have people, and this is a whole other thing, I don't want to particularly get into it, chanting, "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free." If you ask them which river and which sea, half of them do not know. They did a survey, they asked 2,250 people who were on those demonstrations. These people thought Yasser Arafat was the first president of Israel. To listeners who are not familiar with this, he wasn't. He was the head of the Palestinian Resistance Organization called the PLO. So people don't know anything, and they have no experience in democracies. Democracy is not some simple thing that you can just snap your fingers and achieve. No, you go to school. You've been to school. I've been to school. My students have been to school. I ask my students, what's the one thing you learn in every single class? Every single class. You learn to sit down, shut up, and take orders from some schmuck at the head of the room. You don't learn self-management, democracy. No, you don't learn that. You learn to obey.
Unless your teacher is one that is phenomenal.
That's right.
It's truly a master teacher. And you and I both have had those. They've been rare, right?
And no, I never had. I had some good teachers. A couple of brilliant people in graduate school. But no, they all accepted that. But you could make it, if you systematically gave students, starting with kindergartens, what time is kindergarten? Let them vote on that and let it expand. So by the time they get to seniors, they maybe have some real serious input on the curriculum, and let them see what it is to manage. Let them have elections and see what happens when they elect somebody. Sure. Because she's the popular girl and they elect her and she doesn't know anything. Or she takes a little bit of the funds. Let them have experience. Then they will be at the beginning. You know, Oscar Wilde.
How do you give them that experience? That's the question. You know, I taught high school and college for about a decade.
Mm-hmm.
And then I wrote a business plan for my second master's degree on a holistic school/village.
Right.
And I took it to them because this is for at-risk kids, what I was, at least at that, this was right at the turn of the century.
Right.
And I took it to the head of the Arizona Child Protective Services educational programs.
Good for you.
Okay, yeah. This would be the best place to start, or at least one of them.
Right.
And I presented it. He said, "Zen, I love it. You're light years ahead of where we're at, and I don't know if we'll ever get there." So the fact that there was insight, he loved it, right? He saw the value in it.
Right.
Now, that's a person at the head of, as opposed to in the streets,
right, yeah.
Which is what we're talking about. It's that street level information, understanding,
right.
Education that needs to take place to expand our ability to look at things in a broader perspective.
That's
and
right.
See holistically, how does one element affect another? The synergy or lack
right.
of it.
We need experience of the responsibility of being active citizens, and just pulling a lever every 2 years or 4 years is not an active citizenship. And there's so many reasons why that's very difficult now. It's mm-hmm. very difficult.
Do you think
now.
The regenerative cultures, creating regenerative cultures, which are bioregion focused, so it's mm-hmm. less of an area, even in the United States, there's what, half a dozen different bioregions or so.
Mm-hmm.
And would that potentially be a way to engage?
I don't know. I don't think anybody else knows. When I was in the active political movements in the 70s, we spent a lot
of not
time,
knowing in this, right? It's like,
right.
Who knows? Let's try and find out.
I spent a lot of time, which I, and reflection later, considered totally wasted, arguing about strategy. Did we need a mass political party? Did we need a vanguard political party? Should we proletarianize ourselves, those people with PhDs, and go work in factories? What will work? What? Didn't know. We didn't know then, and nobody knows now. When people ask me what to do, what can I as an individual do, Professor Gottlieb, about the environmental crisis? Because that's my major focus. I say you as an individual can join with some other individuals and create a mass movement. Now, whether that takes the form of bioregions, fine, or certain things are a lot bigger than the bioregion, like Exxon, so you need something bigger to struggle with Exxon, a culture of militarism, and on and on. You know, so certain things can be fixed by the neighborhood, some by the bioregion. Some things have to be international. You can't deal with the trade in endangered species of animals by just doing something in your bioregion. Right. Any more than you could deal with CFCs, which are destroying the ozone layer, by something in your, you know, you needed an international conference in Montreal to phase them out, and which happened just in time. So wherever your heart is that connects to other hearts, human hearts, animal hearts, tree hearts, you know, water hearts, that's where you should be involved, because there are people resisting. We're outnumbered. We don't have the power, but we are resisting. And whatever will happen in the future, at least in the present, you can escape from that crushing sense of depression and despair and there's nothing I can do and what's the point anyway? So I'll have another drink or smoke some more weed or just hide in my room or take these goddamn antidepressants, which make me suicidal. No, you can resist.
It's just the opposite of what they're supposed to do, right?
That's right. That's why the first book I wrote in this theme was called The Spirituality of Resistance.
Right.
And that's why the novel, The Sacrifice Zone, the major part of it focuses on this.
In the spirituality of resistance, I find that to be just that phrase replete with setting boundaries, finding yourself, doing, you know, going through the self-love thing. It's like, and being able to resist all of the domineering and domination that is attempted from the societal value systems.
Right. And the societal forces of power. I mean, look, the question of a spirituality resistance, and it's the same question I'm dealing with in the novel, is on the one hand, what does spirituality offer? It says if you practice certain virtues like self-awareness and humility and compassion and love and gratitude, you're going to feel a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's great. However, when I look at what's actually going on in the world, whether it's the Holocaust or environmental destruction or bombing of Gaza or all these kinds of, or what China is doing to the Muslims or the Tibetans or the Mongolians, they have a wide range of activity, the Chinese, I don't feel very peaceful. So how do I put together a spiritual approach to peacefulness without turning myself into somebody who's constantly shutting things out, without living in avoidance and denial?
With those who are saying, well, you know, you can't be in denial of anything that you feel, right? To suppress any of those feelings, those inklings, you push it down into your body it becomes diseased.
That's the same thing in society. That's right. You suffer from a disorder of feelings, said Kierkegaard, the disorder consisting in not having any.
Right.
Yeah. So that's the question. And my answer to that then, and, you know, 25 years ago when I wrote that book and in the novel, is resistance. That in resistance, we connect to the world instead of avoiding it. We express our love instead of keeping it, you know, buried. And that sense of helplessness and I can't do anything and nothing means anything gets dissipated, whether it's a march, a demonstration, whether you're saving a lake, whether you're acting against a pesticide, whether you're trying to get Exxon to pay reparations for its monstrous cruelties against the earth, whether you're talking about the pollution that comes from all military activities, whether you're, you know, talking about the repression of women, but because they're supposed to be more natural than cultural men who are more rational. Oh, my God. You know, whatever the form it may take, right, you resist. And there are people who resist at the cost of their lives, you know, 20 or 30.
Resistance often comes in asking questions. Why is this? Why not this?
That's right. And here's
why do we always feel like we're being confronted when questions are being asked? Do we
well,
just
because
not think that deeply?
People are deeply afraid, and they're not in touch with their fear. So the fear turns to rigidity and anger and violence. Mm-hmm. When my mother-in-law is a survivor of the Holocaust, said when people are scared, they will believe anything to deal with their fear.
Mm.
And take a look at the world. So, you know, in the novel, what I try to ask is, what would a person be like who really had combined these two things? This spiritual understanding of
what
love.
What would a composite hybrid human being look
that's
like?
Right. Right? What would an environmental saint look like? So the major theme of the novel, there's another theme that has to do with drug addiction and Buddhist meditation. But the major theme of the novel is this relationship between a sort of 50-ish professor who discovers the environmental crisis in his 50s and realizes that he, by his sloppiness, he had did something that affected his beloved daughter, and he becomes this rabid environmentalist, but he's filled with rage and grief, and he's sorry, he's one of these screamers, and he meets this woman who's 10 years younger, who's been an environmental activist since college, and while she gets mad at times at the polluter, she's not filled with rage. She's filled with a kind of grace, and she works, she takes chances. In the end, something terrible happens to her. I won't spoiler alert. and he wonders, how does she do it? So the novel describes how she responds, how she thinks, how she behaves, how she is like a nun who's married to the church. She's married to nature. And what does it mean? Does it mean she can't have friends? She has friends. She has a sexual relationship with this guy. She's had sexual relationships with other people, but she's very, you know, relaxed about all that sex. Yeah, she says, it's what all the animals do. I do it too. I enjoy it. And does not make a big deal about it.
Right.
You know, and she cries about
well, and there's
loss.
Not the attachment. It sounds like she doesn't have the attachment, the ownership of the individual.
No, she doesn't.
In relationship to having sex.
That's right. She is married to the earth, and she loves it. She says, this is my family. And he says she's going to take a physical chance to defend something. She says, this is my family. I'm going to defend my family. And so as the novel unfolds, you see the struggles with the polluters, the lies they tell, the violence. They go down to deal with a clear-cut mining, of a mountaintop removal mining, where you mine coal not by digging a hole in the earth. You just cut the top off the mountain. And
right.
It just destroys the ecosystem. All kinds of toxins go into the streams. So they go down to try to deal with that. And he gets beat up, and she gets a gun pointed at her head. And so they go through these guys. They go to a chicken, mass chicken, industrial chicken farm to deal with that. And they go to the chicken company and have this interesting conversation with this woman who's saying, yes, I have concerns about pollution that comes in. No, we've been looking into this, no problem. And then she looks at them and she says, could you be any more stupid, the two of you? And they're like, well, give me a phone. She takes their phones, turns them off, and says, we know we're polluting. We know the chicken is filled with toxins. We know it's bad for people. We know it's terrible for the environment. We don't care. We don't have to. As long as people keep wanting chicken, we're going to keep producing it. Our sales go up every year. The good old boys in Louisiana like it. We have a kosher division. Everybody likes chicken. And that's it. Too bad about the pollution.
But it all tastes like chicken.
Yeah.
As a result.
So those are the kinds of
things.
Speaking
of being chicken.
Right. Those are the kinds of things that go on in the novel.
So in this marriage to nature, right, how deep does that understanding of nature go for us, right? We've got nature, for instance, starting with quantum physics now, it's proving the ancient spiritual teachings of the Vedantic philosophy. With the development of the body, we're now realizing, oh, we're actually made of the earth. Everything that we get and has made the cells in our body has come from the planet, from Mother Earth. So we are her.
That's right.
We don't necessarily look at it that way because we're too busy in the tastes and the, you know, the temptations.
But we can do all sorts of things that are just seem so unnatural. Operating on babies before they're born, right, is pretty weird. Putting people on the moon, you know, identifying.
I talked to one of them, by the way.
All right. Identifying entangled electrons, you know, I mean,
right.
look up entanglement sometimes. That's really mind-blowing. So we can do all that kind of stuff. And also, we are profoundly of the Earth, but we don't know this. Even if you think of an abstraction, nature is an abstraction, the environment is an abstraction. So in my philosophy and the environment class, one of the assignments is that each student has to pick a tree and go visit the tree 3 or 4 times a week, 15, 20 minutes,
mm-hmm.
and keep a little journal record. And I say, you can write whatever you want in the journal. Write, Gottlieb is an idiot. This is the stupidest assignment I've ever had. But it's one tree.
Or you can talk to the tree.
That's right. They all sorts of things happen. And these are, you know, engineers, mathematicians, business students. These are not the kind of kids who go to Swarthmore or Oberlin or something like that. It's a different crowd.
Right.
But they have, most of them do establish a connection. I had one kid who first 2 weeks was Gottlieb is an idiot. Second 2 weeks was, this tree's kind of cool. I think I'll call him George. By the 7th week, end of the term, he's saying, George doesn't look too good today. Leaves are kind of shriveled. I wonder if the acid rain from my driving is hurting George.
Hmm.
So, you know, you want the whole system in mind. Because
that's
it
definitely
is
a transformation of thought.
That's right. But you also want some kind of connection, just like they used to say, who supports gay marriage? People who know somebody who's gay, right? How do you get over some racist feelings? Get somebody of a different race, right? Mm-hmm. Sit down, talk, have a cup of coffee, you know, take a walk, talk, right. Find out what's going on. And it's the same thing with the natural world. This should be an essential element because we don't treat nature or the environment to a great extent, either as an interconnected living system or as actual individuals. We treat it as a background. Something that's pretty, something on a nature special on TV, a screensaver, you know? But that's, oh, it's great. It is beautiful. I mean, there's nothing more beautiful.
Oh, absolutely. Can we think a little deeper, though? And I posit this and to the card-carrying intellectual and you know, see how, you know, expanded a vision you might have. In the understanding of nature, the new information that's coming through the quantum discoveries and the mm-hmm. multidimensional aspect of being human and even having reference in that historically in mm-hmm. some of the spiritual texts as well. We may not read it as such, but viewing it through the lens of science, it's obvious that there are some aspects of that. Now, do you feel that there is a possibility that as we begin to dive further into information that's available now about who we are, how we're structured, the multiple dimensions, and both in experiential science, like with William Swigart's work, or with the quantum physics science, like with the Nepean Close, you know, positing that consciousness of space and time are tethered across 9 dimensions for the human experience. That's the bandwidth that we're operational in. Who knows what we can do without the bodies, and we're in bodies. So these kinds of parameters are being looked at. Is it possible that there is a perfected form, fit, and function in the world that we're designed with, and that through our own query and curiosity about who we are, that we may potentially discover that reality and further create an amalgamation, if you will, that is a more harmonious in its display and ability to interact with the systems that we have in order to change them to serve humanity rather than usurp.
You know, the relationship between knowledge and social transformation is very varied. Sometimes it does a lot, sometimes it does nothing. Mm-hmm. If you think of the way TV communicated, you know, the treatment of blacks in the civil rights movement, or you think of the way it communicated what was going on in Vietnam, that it really did have a powerful effect. I think the first explosion of the environmental movement had to do with things like rivers catching on fire. Wait a minute, a river catching on fire? That's crazy. Yeah, there was so much pollution in it. that the chemicals there would catch on fire. So you do have that. And I think they have aroused, besides people who have a direct experience of it, people who read about it, who hear about it, a global environmental movement, which necessarily, I think, has at least in some parts of it, something like the kind of thing you're talking about, something about adaptation, cooperation, getting along, respect, accepting.
Like there's a natural movement toward that as one shows up and say, instead of what can I get, what can I give?
Yes. On the other hand, 35 years ago, the first popular book about the climate crisis, published by Bill McKibben. There were other things that had been written, but McKibben's was a more popular book. You didn't have to be a scientist to understand. And he's a terrific writer. McKibben is an incredibly good writer. You know, The End of Nature was published 89, 90, something like that. It's been 35 years.
It was an Earth concert, and suppose that there was one that was attending. And
and
the point, 1,700 acres a minute were being destroyed.
That's right. And they still are. And the level of CO2 in the atmosphere continues to rise.
Mm-hmm.
So we had the information for 35 years. And that's why, again, in the novel, I explore, and this is the other theme of the novel, I explore the issue of addiction. The other main character is a woman whose sister becomes a heroin addict. And it literally just destroys the family. And to escape the heartache of that, this woman gets into Buddhist meditation very, very seriously and becomes a Buddhist teacher and sort of abandons her family completely. And then later in life, the memories start to arise and
sure.
Buddhist equanimity.
Like a natural progression. When you get into something, you polarize from everything for a little bit.
You pull apart because that's what she was in a sketch.
Sure.
She needed it. So again, what's going on is not a lack of information. It's a lack of sanity. Mm. If you consider Exxon, right? They knew 30 years ago about global warming. They had a secret email list where they discussed it. Their facilities, their coastal facilities, to strengthen themselves because they knew that the oceans were going to rise. They hired a public relations firm to cast doubt on it, the same public relations firm that the tobacco growers hired to cast doubt on the relation between cigarettes and cancer. So imagine getting up in the morning and that's your job. That's your job, to cast doubt on these realities. So
that doesn't sound
that's
like
the struggle
thing.
Between the global environmental movement for sanity, where some places it can operate freely, like the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Some place, again, if you challenge what's going on in a serious way in China or Russia, you'll go to jail. If you're not, just to finish the sentence, if you do it in North America or Africa, you're liable to get murdered. So, but that's the nature of the struggle, and it's global. Yes, yeah, sorry.
Go ahead. Mm-hmm. Unless you can figure out to stay under the radar or be so visible that your absence would cascade. Now, is there, in looking at things, all right, we're a huge producer of CO2. We know from medical studies that the higher the oxygen content in an environment, the less disease is present, right? So, and even with, happen to know the gentleman that got Magic Johnson hooked up with folks in Mexico to get rid of the AIDS virus. And how they did that was they gave him a total transfusion of oxygenated blood. Mm-hmm. That's all they did.
Right.
So in these environments, how can we create, you know, instead of destroying things that create oxygen, how could we reverse that? It's like, oh, okay, so maybe this is a little more sane activity that we can figure out how to produce high rate of growth vegetation that offers that replenishing of oxygen.
Yeah, I think that'd be a great idea because some of the rainforests are now putting out CO2, not oxygen, because there's so much CO2 in the atmosphere. Again, any one of these things, clean water, clean air, clean food, cultural pollution, the level of cultural pollution, which is not physical in the sense of like a particle of a pesticide in your air, but the cultural pollution of violence and savagery is staggering, right? So any one of these things would be a great idea. You know, like Gandhi said about Western civilization, they said, what do you think of it? And he said, I think it would be a great idea. So any one of these things are great. And the task
potentially
then is to, yeah, Wonderful. You know, teaching people to really treasure gasoline, oil. Oil is this incredible gift we've been given. And we waste it. We just totally, you go down to the cities at night, all the skyscrapers have their lights on, right? Some skyscrapers were made in such a way that you can't turn the lights off. This is crazy, my man. You know, that we treat this like this special, incredible gift only to be used and to be used with gratitude and care. That's how we should use oil, but we don't.
Well, that's how we should use anything.
That's right. Right? Exactly right. Yeah,
there's
the food.
This reverence for life, because
yes,
everything
absolutely.
Is alive in some way, whether it's even just vibrating as a rock.
Right.
Right. There's still energy there.
That's
We
right.
know
That's
from
right.
quantum physics now that there really is no physicality to things. It's all vibrating strings.
Yeah, it's like when we were tripping, you know. It's all vibrations, man. Yeah, well, that's what the string theory people say in physics. It's not necessarily true, but
well,
it's
you could
one
walk down. I
hypothesis.
remember in the dorm, I was living in the honors dorm at Ball State University, and I walked down the hallway and I could feel people in their rooms,
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
whether they were expanded
Right.
or not, right? And there's this activity. Later on, there was a woman that was trained in the Huna way that showed me how to measure auras using dowsing rods. And the demonstration was past, present, and future, where you're at in those and what size is your aura in those places. What was amazing is that in the past and the future, the aura is about 6 foot in diameter. In the present, it's 10 times that. In the demonstration, you know, we were in a 40-foot square room. She barely got two steps in from the other side of the room before the rods opened up when I was in the present moment. Well, the present moment was simply holding a rock and focusing on it. Now, if that's possible in that kind of environment, what else is possible with the conscious effort to be in the present, and what effects would they have on those around us in doing so?
You know, I mean, to be overly simplistic, you know, spiritual teachers have been talking about this for a very long time.
Oh, yeah.
You know, love your neighbor as yourself, care for the enlightenment of all sentient beings, say the Mahayana Buddhists, so forth and so on. But practical people know that that's impractical. What's practical is machines, tractors, big boats, capitalism, the stock exchange, television advertisement. That's what's practical. Well, could it be more clear that the spiritual teachers were right? Take a look at the world. Take a look at what's going on. You know, I think that, you know, I think humanity is at a crossroads. I think that if we continue with the present environmental practices, I don't think modern civilization is going to make it. I don't think every human being will
perhaps
die, but those people who are dependent on the internet and industrialization, I don't think that's going to last. And I think what happens then is you have breakup into tiny, comparatively small groups of people, limited resources, breakdown of the internet, all those kinds of things.
Right. Kind of like the breakup of Ma Bell, right?
Right.
It's
or what
kind
happened
of burial.
With the breakup of the Roman Empire, where you had more fragmentation and you had people who could read sort of confined to monasteries, you know. So, you know, one just can imagine what's going to happen when you get four or five of these mega hurricanes going up the East Coast of the United States, of Florida, the coastal cities in South Carolina, Washington, D.C., Boston, New York. Now, that won't kill everybody. There might be a few thousand deaths, but how much money it will take, how many resources, and then where's the money then for education, healthcare, care for the elderly, care for the disabled, where's the money going to come from? Because either that or all those people will be stuck in poverty. You know, you had
Isn't
like the black people in New Orleans.
All of that is it's a fictitious system.
Yes.
Right? It's just
That's
what
right.
we've placed belief in.
That's right.
And that can
Absolutely.
change
Yes.
overnight.
Yes. That's right. That's right. That we who could, and that's why, you know, in spirituality resistance, I link up the Holocaust and the environmental crisis in a number of different ways. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways is that nobody thought this was possible. Germany was the most cultured country. It had a 100, 200-year history of advances in music, in science, in art, in political theory. It was incredible. Anthropology, archaeology, all the leaders were all German. Mm-hmm. In those things. And in a very short time, the mechanized power of the modern state was turned toward the annihilation of the Jews. And people began to believe the most insane, crazy, self-contradictory ideology of anti-Semitism. So when people say, oh no, it couldn't happen. Well, yeah, it happened. And it wasn't a bunch of tribes people, God, help us, who aren't modernized. These were modernized people. You know, the man many people consider the most important philosopher of the first 50 years of the century, Martin Heidegger, signed on to anti-Semitism. You know, if you study the history of philosophy, Heidegger is this huge name. He signed on to anti-Semitism. The leading people in law signed on to making the laws which distinguished how many ancestors you had who were Jewish made you a Jew. That's what they did. And now you have some of the most brilliant minds working in Wall Street, finance capital, Exxon, plastic companies. I mean, Exxon is basically a plastic company. Mm-hmm. All plastic comes from petroleum. And that's where they're investing very heavily now because they're scared that oil won't be used for power, but the plastic, no stopping that. Right. So you get these people and one has to ask, what is the mentality of such a person? These are not stupid people in any technical sense. They get great board scores. They go to the best colleges. They wear the best suits. They belong to the best clubs, you know, and now with the rise of feminism, thank God, women are in their ranks as well.
Right.
What oh, do they you think mentioned that they're doing?
Years, oh gosh, it's been 30 years ago when I was first doing the early round of this type of conversation. One of my guests was a guy by the name of Willie Whitefeather. He was a mixed blood Cherokee storyteller. And he said, one of their prophecies is that soon the women will be cutting their hair and putting on war paint and going to battle. I had interviewed him in 1990. And it was, you know, during that time, I know I came out of the aerospace industry from the 80s. Women were cutting their hair short, put the makeup on, put the business suits on and trying to, you know, manage in the traditionally male-oriented environment. That's they right. ought to be able to, first of all, don't get me wrong on that, but this was something that had not been allowed, and now the women are deciding, okay, by golly, we're gonna show you guys how it's done.
Right, and there was the fantasy that women somehow wouldn't be as bad as men, and that fantasy has been crushed because they are.
Well, once it's they the get, because it's the, not the it's individual. The
position. That's right, exactly right. It's the position. It's like a... you know, if you have to fit into something, that's the mold. And if you don't can't fit into the mold, you won't be there. So you have to fit into the mold. You have to behave in a certain way. It, you know, and I love the way every time a corporation is caught doing something disgusting, they got some woman as a spokesperson, right, to justify what they've done and say, oh, we've been studying this completely and we're doing better. And it's all a bunch of lies. So
we don't realize how psychologically manipulated we are by all of these intellectually bound, okay, if we're going to do this, then this is the strategy that we have to use to do the whatever thought modification is necessary to get these people in line.
Yes, yes. And look, there's hardly anything stupider on earth than a human baby. They don't know anything. They eat. They excrete, they sleep, they cry. They have to be taught. So mm-hmm. if you're taught that violence is a good thing, success at any cost is a good thing, if you got to have this kind of house, you got to hate that group, you got to treat this group as second-class citizens, you know, you have to, that's just, of course, they'll learn it.
Right.
You know, in and South
as
Pacific,
they will
right?
also learn if they're put in an environment that's caring and nurturing and
that's
loving
right.
and
exactly
supports
right.
them. You know, it's like, again, the aspect of holistic education. Do
yes.
the assessment. What's your aptitude? What's
right.
your attitude? What are your natural skill sets? And what are your natural inclinations as far as where you want to go and how you might want to apply that, at least on the short term? Because we're not going to know what your you know, kind of like the Russians did when they took a kid early on. This is what my wife went through. She was raised in the USSR, and she became a piano pedagogue. They picked her at 5 years old, took her completely through the educational system, which was just compared to America, this was so robust. The
Oh
information,
yeah. Oh no.
education
Not
had all.
the level of education. I mean, Americans are not very well educated. I
Oh,
mean,
not at
my
all. And we don't see the comparisons because we just grow up in America
That's right. That's right.
until we
You
start
know.
dealing with foreigners that are
Yeah.
far more intelligent, know more than we do.
I mean,
How'd that happen?
Kierkegaard, to graduate from high school, had to know Greek, Latin, and Hebrew. And
Hmm.
Hebrew. He's a Protestant. He's going to a Protestant school. He had to know Hebrew. He had to translate a section of Genesis for his final exam. So, yeah, I mean, my mother-in-law survived the Holocaust. She went to high school in Poland. And what she studied in Poland to get out of high school, you know, Poland, not a, and it wasn't a very good high school, she said. It was for poor people. She was a poor Jew. So she couldn't go to the best high schools by any means. Yeah, but what saves us, or might save us, or can save us, are the contradictions, the tendencies of the system that disrupt the system. So if you think of women and blacks in the 1950s, 1960s, that we're America, we're democracy, everybody's equal here. And they realized they weren't.
Activity,
And
actions didn't show it.
so they created the, you know, the civil rights movement and the feminist movement.
Right.
And people have seen with their own eyes or read the distressing accounts of what is happening. You know, when a river catches on fire, when now I'm old enough to remember when there were five times as many mosquitoes and flies in the summertime. They're all dead. They're all gone. I mean, there are places in Germany where they've measured two-thirds of the insects aren't there anymore. So you can see it, you can feel it. Hopefully, you can make some kind of connection that, for instance, cancer is not just some personal tragedy that happens to your mother, your father, your sister, whatever. Terrible, awful, horrible. But it's socially engendered to some degree, sometimes to a massive degree,
Right, it's
by
like we
pollution.
know how we think, how
Pollution.
we feel. We stuff energy and we
Right.
have emotional, energetic, psychic, even physical, you
Chemical,
know,
yeah.
blockages in our bodies that
Right.
inhibit this natural flow of energy in them. We don't even realize that our bodies are transceivers.
Right.
Right?
So again, they come back to the theme of resistance. Then what do you do? When the contradictions become clear, when you find out that this lovely 52-year-old woman, who was by one of my daughter's godmothers, got cancer, and she got this very rare kind of cancer, and her father got it too, and that they lived next to a golf course, right? With all the chemicals they spray in a golf course, horrible consumption of chemicals, pesticides and you know, fertilizers. But then what do you do with that knowledge? Well, can you join with people to talk about the limitation of pesticides? Can you challenge the people in the government who sign off on it, sign off on it, sign off on it?
Well, this means there has to be some self-organization,
Yeah.
right? There has to be a willingness to gather.
That's right. Absolutely.
And that really hasn't been present, especially with what happened to the COVID. It's like, no, you're not going to gather anywhere. And so that's the push back.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
It's like a rubber band. Now, what's going to happen when that rubber band snaps?
Well, take a look at Russia. The people who stood up against the Ukraine war are dead or in jail. That's what happens, you know. And take a look at the country now. And there are more than a few totally fringe people who say, you know, and one of them is the Speaker of the House of Representatives, who say this is a white nation, white Christian nation. Christian nation? That kind of leaves me out. I'm Jewish. It's a Christian nation. Now, what would he do if he had, if you know, he had enough people in the House of Representatives and a supportive president to establish that this is a Christian nation? What would he do? And nothing to do with the people who created this nation. That's all a pack of lies. So we're on the edge of that. We're on the edge. And it's worked very well in Russia. It's worked very well in China. Their resistance has been all but completely stamped out in those two countries. And those are, you know, and it's they're working on it in India, with the repression of Muslims there. They're working on it there. So, and if you get India along with China and Russia, well, that's more than half the human race. Right? They'll be going to fascism. And they have friends. You know, Donald Trump likes these people because he's a fascist too. So that's one possible future. You know, Orwell said at the end of his book, 1984, it's a boot stamping into a human face forever.
Mm-hmm.
And there is resistance. And there is they're incredibly brave people. You go to countries like that, you speak up. Feminists in Muslim world, they start off in those countries. They have to leave, otherwise they'll be murdered. You can't be a feminist in a Muslim-dominated country.
Mm-hmm.
There are these incredible the women of Iran and men supporting them, going out in the street. We don't want to wear this schmata on our heads, right? We want women, life, freedom. That's their chant. It'd be simpler. Is that some terribly threatening thing? Well, it is to the people who control Iran, the religious right. theocrats who control the money. It's certainly threatening to them. So you have these people who show enormous courage. Are these people perfect? No. They're, you know, some of them are jerks, like me, like you. But they give love. And in giving love, they connect to this marvelous miracle that we've been given.
Right.
And in that connection, something happens.
It's been said, and this is it's an off-planet reference, I'll admit this. So, you know, I mentioned earlier in our pre-show that I had met and spoken with, actually developed a friendship with one of the men who was on the moon, Dr. Edgar Mitchell. Very astute, kind, warm, loving, wanting to explore the realms of consciousness because of what happened to him,
mm-hmm.
that it expanded his mind on that
right.
journey.
Yeah.
And then Wilbert Smith, who ran Canada's UFO investigation program in the 1950s, very similar to America's Project Blue Book, it was that level.
Mm-hmm.
He had conversations with others. One of the things other people from elsewhere is what he called them, because they're from many different star systems. Consistent in their framing of understanding was that time to them isn't a clock. It's a measurement in the change of entropy. That's a really interesting point of potential order. Because it would indicate that the more active, harmoniously we are, the less time it's going to take to actually accomplish things.
Well,
that be
you know, you can you can get a lot done if you cooperate.
Absolutely.
And if you cooperate in a democratic, fair, rational way, then you can get a lot done that's good. You can also get a lot done if you cooperate that's horrible. I mean, the Holocaust was this marvelously modern, mechanized, cooperative form.
So with 9/11, right?
That's
that
right.
was the
that's right.
organized activity.
Yes. So it's not just, you know, it's what people talk about is everything's about relationship. I think it's not about relationship. It's about a certain kind of relationship, because a master-slave connection is also a relationship. It's not a good one, certainly not for the slave. Not great spiritually for the master either, but certainly physically it's more comfortable, a hell of a lot more comfortable.
And we're all in relationships
that's
on
right.
the ocean of emotion, seeking safe harbor
that's right.
with
that's
each
right.
other.
That's right. And what we use to achieve that safety, power, money, control, status at the expense of other groups who have less status or no status whatsoever, although those things are ephemeral, and the way we're and if you pursue them with a high technology society, they're going to be incredibly destructive. You know, the consumerism of the American population is incredibly destructive. You know,
so
the notion
how can
that
we at least be not only aware of that, which I think that's may not be ubiquitous, but there's enough concern about that. Mm-hmm. How can we shift that for our collective future that would be at least in subtly in a more positive way that could then roll out into a wave of change? What do you think is the essence of that?
I don't think there is an essence. And The simple answer is I don't know, and the only thing I'm sure of is nobody knows. But secondarily
What
to
if we
that,
did, though? What might it look like?
I would say take a look at where you are and ask yourself, what makes sense? What really makes sense? What's fair? Where's the love? Recognizing that it's not just about your wife, husband, children, grandmother, whatever, but it's about all these other beings that we have relationships with. You know, every time I drive my car, I contribute to global warming. The people of Bangladesh get another storm, 20,000 people die. I'm in connection to all these beings. Now, how can I, with the cooperation and input and exchange from other people, can't do it all by myself. Nobody's smart enough, not even me. No, especially not me. But with input and connection from other people, how can I create a more loving, harmonious existence as somebody who is connected, knowing that, you know, no matter where I live, no matter how clean my diet, I am dependent on a global economic system, and therefore a global technological system, and therefore a global environmental system. That's what I'm part of. So think globally. If you can act globally, great. If you can act locally, act. Do something. Connect. Value. Be aware with deepest possible gratitude of what we've been given. And out of a deep, committed love, try to give some back.
Awesome. Oh, this has been just an amazing conversation, Roger, and I totally appreciate the depth. And you know, it sounded probative in ways that aren't necessarily alluding the greatness or toward the greatness that we are. And yet, the opportunity, you know, the mentioning of I don't know, well, what if we did? That's a question. You know, what might it be if all things were one? And we're just individual threads in that. How can we be a better thread?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. And it's that kind of simple realization that then complexity and actually, you know, how to do it, because it rolls out over time and with incremental steps in doing so.
God willing.
Yeah, from your
God willing.
Mouth to God's
ears.
Mouth
to God's ears. Yeah, that's right.
So, Roger, I truly appreciate you and your time and how you've been able to affect young minds in a potentially better future as we all grow together.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure to talk with you. And as you say, go in good health. Go in good health.
Thank you. As you as well. And namaste.
Take care. Namaste, namaste.
And in la catch. And thank you for sticking with us for this episode of One World in a New World. I'm your host, Zen Benefiel, and I'll see you next time.